bien, nous allons commencer notre soirée. Bonsoir à tous. En tant que responsable national du MCC, c'est un grand plaisir de vous accueillir et d'introduire cette rencontre. Nous sommes nombreux ce soir, ici à Paris, mais aussi en région, par l'intermédiaire de la chaîne YouTube du Centre Sèvres, sur laquelle cette soirée est retransmise. Je voudrais souhaiter tout particulièrement la bienvenue à ceux d'entre vous qui ne sont pas membres du MCC. Comme vous le savez sans doute, le MCC rassemble autour de 4000 personnes en situation de responsabilité, cadres ou dirigeants, engagés dans le monde économique et social. Ce qui nous rassemble, c'est que nous sommes désireux de mieux vivre l'Évangile au cœur de notre vie professionnelle et personnelle. Nous sommes organisés en équipe, nous nous réunissons chaque mois pour réfléchir ensemble, en vérité, à partir de nos expériences et sous l'éclairage de l'Évangile. Nos quelques 400 équipes qui couvrent toute la France sont ouvertes à accueillir de nouveaux membres et n'hésitez pas à vous faire connaître ce soir si vous souhaitez plus d'informations. Au-delà de la vie d'équipe, le MCC organise aussi un certain nombre d'événements permettant d'ouvrir des perspectives et des réflexions plus larges. Et la rencontre de ce soir en est un bel exemple. Elle a été organisée en partenariat avec le Centre Sèvres et la revue Projet. Je veux donc remercier le Centre Sèvres de mettre à disposition ses locaux et ses moyens techniques pour cette soirée. Le Centre Sèvres, c'est l'Institut d'enseignement et de recherche de la Compagnie de Jésus en France. C'est là que sont formés les jésuites francophones, mais également de nombreux religieux ou laïcs. La revue Projet est également partenaire de cette soirée. Projet, c'est la revue du CERAS, le centre de recherche et d'action sociale, qui est engagé depuis plus de 100 ans dans la réflexion sur la justice sociale. Le CERAS s'est impliqué avec nous pour préparer cette rencontre et je les en remercie également vivement. Je veux remercier enfin les membres du MCC qui se sont engagés pour la préparation de cette rencontre. Un grand merci à Mireille Viora qui a relancé ce qu'on appelait les débats Varennes. La rencontre de ce soir s'inscrit dans ce bel héritage. Et merci aussi, bien sûr, à la nouvelle équipe animée par nos anciens responsables nationaux, Tristan et Patricia, qui ont conduit la préparation de cette rencontre. Nous partageons avec Tristan et Patricia la même vision de ce que doivent être ces rencontres du MCC. Un temps d'interpellation, sous un mode un peu créatif, je n'en dis pas plus, vous verrez. Un temps d'échange avec des personnalités de premier plan venant d'horizons et des courants de pensée divers. Et également un temps de rencontre et d'échange dans la convivialité. Voilà qui fait beaucoup de remerciements. Je vais passer la parole à Patricia et remercier surtout notre invité, Arnoud Rosa, et notre animateur, Grégoire Catin.
Merci. Merci Véronique. Bonsoir à tous. Bonsoir à vous qui êtes avec nous dans cette salle. Bonsoir à vous qui nous suivez en direct de Nancy, de Dijon, d'Aix-en-Provence, de Bordeaux, des Yvelines et d'ailleurs, via la chaîne YouTube du Centre Sèvres. C'est vraiment un grand plaisir d'être avec vous. Je vous propose sans attendre d'entrer dans le sujet avec nos 5 intervenants. Certains sont un peu en retard, ils ne devraient pas tarder. En attendant, je vais vous présenter Hartmut Rosa et Grégoire Catin. Hartmut, vous étiez avec nous il y a 2 ans à notre congrès pour nous parler d'accélération devant 1600 personnes. Vous nous faites l'honneur de revenir aujourd'hui et nous en sommes très heureux. Vous êtes philosophe et sociologue, professeur à l'université d'Iéna. Vous observez la frénésie de nos rythmes de vie et vous développez une pensée très juste sur le phénomène de l'accélération. Vous publiez « Accélération, une critique sociale du temps » aux éditions La Découverte, traduit dans le monde entier. Puis « Aliénation et accélération », 150 pages pour ceux qui manquaient de courage face aux 500 pages du premier essai. Mais vous allez au-delà de l'observation et de la pensée critique. vous réfléchissez à des solutions. Votre livre aujourd'hui, ce sont ses réponses. Résonance, une sociologie de notre relation au monde, vient tout juste de sortir en France. Il est salué par toute la presse. Nous remercions son éditeur La Découverte, partenaire de cette soirée. Je me tourne maintenant vers Grégoire, qui sera notre animateur et notre discutant. Grégoire, tu avais dialogué avec Hartmut Rosa lors de notre congrès et tu nous fais l'amitié de revenir ce soir. Tu es jésuite, docteur en théologie de l'Université de Boston. Tu as passé plusieurs années comme chercheur au CERAS. Tu viens d'être nommé directeur du service national Famille et Société de la Conférence des évêques de France. La discussion aura lieu en anglais, mais vous aurez une traduction en français sur cet écran grâce à Louise et Sarah. C'est une traduction amateur et nous vous remercions par avance de votre indulgence. Bon, il nous manque toujours nos trois intervenants. J'espère qu'ils vont arriver rapidement.
Vite, vite, on est en retard. Ils sont déjà tous là.
On se détend. C'est pas parce qu'on va parler de l'accélération du temps qu'il faut être speed.
Je suis crevée, j'ai pas envie d'y aller à cette conférence. Est-ce que ça vaut vraiment le coup?
Plus vite on commence, plus tôt on finit.
Allez, on respire et on y va.
Moi, j'ai essayé de résister à l'accélération du temps. J'ai changé de vie. J'ai passé 3 mois dans une yourte en Mongolie. Au menu, foie de mouton et lait d'yak. J'ai perdu 15 kilos. Tout autour de moi, il y avait des pâtures à perte de vue. Chaque jour, je regardais les pâtures. Les yaks me regardaient. Je regardais les yaks. J'ai été rapatrié sanitaire. Je présentais des signes avancés de démence.
Moi, c'est Madame Tech Addict. Facebook, Twitter, Uber, Netflix, Google Maps, Candy Crush, WhatsApp. Je suis une accro aux écrans. Sans eux, je suis perdue. Je les cherche constamment. J'ai essayé de me sevrer, j'y arrive pas. Je sais plus comment faire. Comment est-ce qu'on faisait avant?
Moi, j'ai essayé de ralentir. En 10 leçons sur Google. Maintenant, je suis slow food, slow tourisme, slow fashion, slow business, slow coffee. Je fais des pauses. Je contemple. Entre les deux, je prends mon temps. Alors, il y a bien quelques inconvénients. Ma fille est en retard tous les matins à l'école. Mon mari a fini aux urgences à la suite d'une allergie aux graines de lin. Et mes amis sont tous partis du restaurant quand j'ai à peine terminé mon entrée. Plus je ralentis, plus ça s'accélère.
Que vous faites ?
Je ris avec toi. J'écoute de la musique.
Qu'est-ce que vous faites ?
Je me balade dans Paris. Je prie.
Enfin, qu'est-ce que vous faites ?
Je te fais un hug. Je lis un texte qui me plaît.
Enfin ! Mais qu'est-ce que vous faites ?
Je regarde la mer. Je te regarde.
Je suis ponctuée d'oscillations harmonieuses. Je provoque des variations intenses. J'impulse le rythme, je fais vibrer. Je vous apporte la confiance. Je ne suis pas née en France. On m'a pourtant aperçue à l'île de Ré, dans ces instants précieux, entre les mouettes, les vagues et ces huîtres dont vous faites bombance. Je suis intérieure, discrète, et je vous mets en transe. Mon pouvoir vous fait sentir la transcendance de l'unité du monde, la fulgurance de l'union des âmes. De cette musique cosmique, vous en êtes l'une des notes.
Le jour où j'ai écouté avec mon cœur, le jour où j'ai fermé ma gueule, le jour où j'ai pleuré pour rien, le jour où j'ai arrêté de juger mon reflet dans le miroir, le jour où tu as posé ta main dans la mienne,
le jour où j'ai pris le temps d'écouter les autres, le jour où j'ai trouvé du sens à mon travail, le jour où j'ai réalisé mes rêves d'enfant, le jour où j'ai renoué des liens familiaux,
le jour où j'ai organisé la collecte du compost de mon immeuble. Le jour où j'ai humé les lauriers roses dans le champ des cigales et baigné par le soleil de l'Estérel.
Le jour où j'ai ri dans le métro, fort.
Le jour où je me suis dépassée en sport.
Le jour où j'ai pris un aller, sans retour.
Le jour où j'ai profité pleinement de l'instant présent.
Le jour où j'ai engueulé mon boss. Le jour où j'ai arrêté de faire des listes. Le jour où j'ai regardé les toits de Paris. Le jour où je suis devenue mère.
Le jour où j'ai fait ripaille dans un bon restaurant à Brive. Un jour de grève SNCF.
Le jour où j'ai été émue et bouleversée. Le jour où je me suis vraiment reposée.
Le jour où j'ai gagné ma première vente. Le jour où une vingtaine de dauphins ont entouré notre bateau en jouant avec nous.
Le jour où j'ai prié à genoux, bras ouverts. Le jour où j'ai décidé de jouer sur scène et pas dans ma vie. Le jour où j'ai goûté des bulots, maillots.
Le jour où j'ai aimé. Le jour où j'ai admiré un magnifique paysage.
Le jour où j'ai caressé un arbre. Le jour où j'ai retrouvé le parfum de mon père. Le jour où mon fils a dit maman. Ce jour-là,
ma relation a changé.
Nos trois intervenants surprises étaient Sabrina De Luca, Florence Cérès Pierre Démerger. Ce sont trois membres du MCC, comédiens amateurs, avec leur metteuse en scène Pauline Guilherme, ils ont fait un travail formidable, nous pouvons encore les applaudir. Avant d'introduire la discussion, peut-être Hartmut, Grégoire, avant d'engager cette discussion plus avant, peut-être une réaction par rapport à ce que nous venons d'entendre.
Yes, I think it's a good start to try to understand what you want to tell us with your concept of resonance.
Yeah,
but there's something that can help us to understand what you mean by resonance when you've seen this little play.
Yeah, I think it's. Doing this is very, very difficult, right? I've wrote 530 pages, right? And then you turn it into a small play. But on the other hand, I want to connect it to real everyday life experiences, and that's what they tried to capture. I quite like that. Even though I'm always getting a little nervous, but when it creates the idea that it's a very romantic notion of, you know, being in hugging trees or so on, that's a kind of dangerous route, right? For a sociologist, then you look like in a kind of esoteric version of the self-help section, and that then makes me a bit nervous. But I think, nevertheless, I think it's a good way to introduce an artistic element and to try to bring it down. And in it rings different keys, right? So I quite like that.
So tell us now. You start your book. Slow. Yeah.
No.
You start your book with what has been put also in red, in the French translation. If acceleration is the problem, maybe resonance is a solution. So could you explain us a bit about resonance? What do you mean?
Well, let me start with why resonance could be the solution, as you just said, to acceleration. When I did we had this in this theatrical opening, right? I had the idea, the analysis that modern life is permanently short on time. We are all in this hamster wheel, right? And many things change probably too quickly. At least the speed of modern life creates a lot of problems. And then a lot of people said, oh, Mr. Rosa, Hartmut Rosa is the guy for slowness. I was even called the guru of deceleration, right? And I thought, well, that is really strange because I have not written a book about slowness. I have written the book about speed, right? An analysis of what was going on. And I did not feel that slowness is the solution to the problem, right? And this is for two reasons. One reason is that we cannot just leave everything as it is and just slow down, right? We live in that's sociologically, that's the most important point. A modern society needs, or a capitalist modern society needs speed, acceleration, innovation, growth in order to stay where we are. Right. Without this permanent increase, we lose our form. So just to slow down cannot be the solution. And secondly, slowness is not very desirable. I think we've heard this before too, right? When there's an emergency and you need the fire ambulance or the doctor, it's not great if it's slow, right? And a slow internet connection is just awful, right? We all hate that. So it can't be that slow is good and fast is bad. So I thought, well, what is really bad about fastness? It's if it turns our way of being in the world, of relating to each other, into a form of alienation. You cannot really truly appropriate things. So my idea was alienation is acceleration is bad if it creates alienation. And then I asked myself, and others asked me, well, but what is a non-alienated state of affairs? When are you not alienated from the world? And then resonance is my answer to that, right? I'm not alienated from the world. I'm in the right mode of connecting, for example, this evening to you, right? When we manage to create a kind of sphere of resonance, which is the sense that we are all in it together, that there is something we want to exchange and that this exchange moves and transforms us, for example, right now in dialogue. And that's a different way of relating to the world, of being in the world. It even changes our mode of existence. And if we do change our mode of existence or let this happen, that might solve the problem of acceleration too.
Yes. When you speak about the world, you understand the world in a quite wide understanding. It's me in relation to the world, but the world is the other people.
The world, yeah. Mm.
It could be also the material world, nature, the trees, and so on. But it can be also something that is further away or that is more global. Could be a transcendence, could be nature as a whole. art. And so you have those three dimensions. So maybe we can move on into some specific areas in order to capture better what you try to do. Let's start with work. Through work, of course, we are in relation to the world. We are in relation. The baker is in relation with the dough in order to make bread. If I'm a scientist, I'm in relation with the book that I read and with the post-its and so on. But also in the world we're living in, there is a sense that when we work in a company or big things, sometimes we feel that we are not resonating. We are with our world. Work. There is the sense also, it's what you mentioned in your book, that maybe capitalism or productivism, finances, maybe they have ruined everything. So how can we find resonance? I mean, or what is the problem of resonance in the ambit of work?
Yeah, I don't think neither capitalism nor financialism can ruin everything. I mean, if everything is ruined, then we are gone as human beings. Because as human beings, we are resonant beings, right? All of you know moments of resonance. It's a certain form of being in contact with the world. And for me, very often we are in a different mode. You could really say, with Herbert Marcuse, most of the time the world becomes a point of aggression. And when you get up in the morning, or I get up in the morning, we have a long list, a to-do list, a list of things to do, right? Oh, I need to call this one. Okay, done. I need to get this done. I need to buy that. I need to fulfill that task. Oh, I have to answer that person and so on. I have to wash my clothes and so on. It's a long, the world in this sense appears as a point of aggression. How can I know it? How can I have it? How can I master it? And so on. And resonance is a different way of being in the world, of relating to things which you all know. And let me, I will turn to work in a second, but it's important to describe that different mode, which is not commanding, mastering. It's not aggression, right? It's listening and answering, right? So if you allow, I will briefly tell you what my definition of resonance, right? It's a form of getting in touch with someone or something, music, nature, a book. Could be the Bible, could be the Capital by Marx, whatever it is, right? In a certain form, and this form of being in touch has four elements. Number one, this something is somehow touching me. It's speaking to me, right? It's not, oh, I need to somehow empty this glass. But it's the feeling that somehow there is something about this glass that touches me, that speaks to me. I don't know exactly what it is, but there is something in it. So the number one is you feel affected. It's really the idea something is calling you. And this something could be a real person who says, oh, please help me. That's a call. And you can close down. No, I don't have any time. I need to get to the station. Or you can somehow open up. It's really speaking to me. But it can be music you hear. It's touching. And you feel it changes your mode of being in the world. So affection is the first element. But the second element is just as important. It means you react, you answer. Right? It's like affection is moving inward. Something touches me. And the second element is, I call it self-efficacy. You can actually also call it emotion, from emovere, moving outwards. You answer it. Right? For example, if something happens here, like the theater, the play, you might actually have two reactions. One could be alienation, and that's either I feel bored by it, or I feel this is totally stupid. That's repulsion, right? But if you feel touched by it and you feel it speaks to you, then you really see how you even bodily react to it. You open up to it. Maybe your eyes beam, or maybe the whole way you sit changes, and you start to reflect. And there you even see the third element. So the second element is, the first is moving inward, something touches me. The second is I answer it. I move outward and I reach the other side. I make connection, I make contact with this other side. And if this happens, there is a transformation. We do not stay the same in this process, right? And we transform ourselves. When you hear a music which you like, or an idea which is proposed to you and it really touches you and you start to think about it, then after the experience you think differently, or you are differently. And the fourth element is you cannot really control this process. for those of you who speak German, I mean, in German, I use this particular word. It's called Unverfügbarkeit. And unfortunately, you cannot translate it well.
But in French, we translate it by disponible, indisponibilité. The fact that you cannot comprehend something, you cannot completely control it. And in French, it works pretty well. And it's the word used in the book, indisponible, une dimension d'indisponibilité.
And what it means is very easy to grasp. It means you cannot control resonance. You don't know when it happens, right? I might really try to resonate with you, but you sit there and say, I don't get it. It's boring, right? And I cannot bring it about by speaking faster, which unfortunately I often do, or bringing louder. So I cannot make sure, and you cannot make sure either. You might go to your favorite concert and nothing happens. You're not touched. But the second, more important point of indisponibilité is that if it happens, you don't know what the result is. You are transformed, but you don't know in which way. Something speaks to you, you react to it, and that transforms you in an unpredictable way. So why I'm saying this is because now you have the picture of resonance. Yeah. It's a contact with a world where you feel self-efficacy. I reach out, and it's important what's happening. And this transforms me, but I cannot control it completely. And in your work experience, your work experience actually has exactly this form very often. Because I really claim work for most people, even under capitalist wage slave conditions, if you're a Marxist, even there, right, most people say they like their work. Right? People love to work. And why is that? Because when you work, you are actually somehow in this contact with the world, right? You feel it's important what you do because it has a certain meaning. It connects you even to society as a whole. But also you feel self-efficacy. I can reach out and shape this other thing. But whatever the other thing is, as you said, my father, for example, he was a baker, right? And he always talked in terms of resonance about the dough. He said, you know, when you have the dough, you have to give it its time, right? If you want to rush it, the bread will be very bad. But he also said every time the bread is somehow different, right? So I do feel self-efficacy because yes, I can do it well, but it seems like this dough has a kind of resistant quality. It's an object in the world which I encounter and speaks its own voice. And now, there is a thought which Marx developed well, but also Hannah Arendt and others. They say, while I work on the object, I shape myself. That's the transformative aspect, right? In work, you feel you encounter something which is important. You feel your own powers. You can shape something, self-efficacy. And in this process of working, you're transformed. And you cannot completely control the outcome and you don't know what it does to you. And it's not only the baker with the dough or the carpenter with the wood or the gardener with the flowers or the teacher with the kids or the doctor with the organs. It's like if you write texts, like for example, I do, right? When I write the resonance book, right? I don't have complete control of it, right? I somehow feel self-efficacy. Yes, I hope I'm a good sociologist and a good writer, but I do not have complete control of it. The text always says something different from what I want to say. So it's a permanent process of resonance. I try to say something, the text speaks for itself. While I write, I transform my thinking and I transform the text. And writing is so difficult. Procrastination is that's c'est un problème très grave dans l'université. Et c'est parce que ça, parce que l'indisponibilité, you never know whether you will manage to do it well today or not. So that's why while we work, we are always looking for resonance. And when we are permanently pressed for time and permanently have to increase productivity and meet certain targets, right, and report on every step we do, then this resonant quality is undermined and people get frustrated and burned out. That's my short story.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you, because with that we understand better that definitely this concept of resonance is not something about simply harmony or something that. It's about responsivity, having some relation that are responsive, that you enter into something where there is a moving in and out, in and out. Let's move to another sphere of resonance, whom you address also in the book, more in the, what you call the the axe of the more vertical axe of basically what goes with something that is beyond what we are, that is more the whole. And it's where you speak about religion. So how religion, in your understanding, has something to do with this, I would say, this quest for resonance or the issues with a muted world. I mean, sometimes it's the other face. When the world is not resonant, that means that it's...
Yes.
The world is muted.
Yeah, but you know, I'm a sociologist, right? So I'm not theologian or a priest or anything of that sort. So I do not start with any metaphysical assumptions, right? Mm-hmm. I start with phenomenological observation. What do we do as human beings and how is society working? And then as a sociologist, you start to wonder why do most societies have some form of religion or religious beliefs, right? How could that develop and why is it such a strong force? Actually, sociology thought for many decades religion will lose its importance in the modern world. Actually, it will go away, but so far it did not quite get away, right? It's still strong and important. So why is it? And I believe the concept of resonance can explain this. For me, it explains it very well. I mean, I think you already mentioned it. For me, resonance, this way, this sense of being in resonance with the world has three dimensions. One is if your life is in resonance, right, with and I would even claim you have a good life, when you have access of resonance with some other people, right, it could be the people you love, you have a family with, the partners or the kids or good friends. Or if you're a teacher, it can be the pupils, of course. Or if you're a priest, it could be your congregation or so. But you have to have horizontal axis of resonance. I even believe politics is a horizontal axis of, it can be one, should be one. It probably isn't, right? Where you reach out and you feel touched by others. But that's only, the intersubjective realm is only one. The second we just talked about, the materiality of the world. It's the dough and it's the wood and it's the environment you live in. But I believe human beings need a sense of how they are connected with life itself, with what Karl Jaspers calls the ultimate or the encompassing reality, right? You need a sense, and we have a sense, with what connects us to the ultimate thing which is out there, right? In a certain way, I follow Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who says, at the beginning of our awareness, it's not here is I and there is the world. It's just the sense something is there, something is present. And the question now is, what is the nature of this presence? Right? And I believe human beings need a sense that at the bottom of their existence and beyond the world in its totality, there is an axis of resonance. There's some answering relationship, right? At least we yearn for that. We hope that we find a kind of resonance and at the bottom of our existence. Now, religion provides us with exactly this sense, right? I read the Bible, for example, as a document of yearning, of shouting, of calling, of hoping for someone to hear us, someone to see us, somehow to answer. And the Bible gives this, and religion gives this promise, yes, there is someone who sees you, who hears you not on the surface of your existence, but at the bottom of your existence as the ultimate reality. So it's really, you know, I came to the idea of an axis when I thought about prayer, the practice of praying, right? So what do we do when we pray? We close our eyes and we somehow turn inward and outward at the same time, right? You open up your innermost being and connect to the outermost reality. So, and the idea is, of course, we don't hear what God says, at least normally not. Most of the time we think we hear what God says. We should rather see the doctor, right? but nevertheless, it's kind of opening up this sense of being connected in a resonant being. You know, the Bible says, it's this great line, that on the one hand, God gives us the breath of life. That's a moment of resonance, right? And I like, for example, this line, I have called you by your name, you are mine, right? That's the idea, there's someone calling me, and that provides a sense to my being. Now, religion is not the only way of having such a vertical sense of resonance. In modernity, for example, our experience of nature actually, in very interestingly, has the same dimension. People think the ultimate reality is a nature we are placed in. And nature is a powerful force which runs through us. So when you stand at the ocean, for example, and the waves roll in, you have the same axis. You feel, you can see this if you use modern technologies. People change the way they breathe and the way they stand, and they open up to the ocean coming in. And they say, when you do interviews, they actually tell you, when I hear this vastness out there, I can feel myself again, right? That's connection. That's the same axis. I turn inward and outward at the same time. Or art can be such an axis of existential resonance. For example, people go to concerts, and it can be a heavy metal concert. I know from my own experience, right? A lot of people do close their eyes, and they feel, it's very interesting to ask yourself, where is the music? Is it out there or is it in me? It's the same axis, right? My innermost essence is somehow connected to the outermost world. If you're a total Marxist, my last example, then I shut up. If you're a Marxist, then it's not nature or art, it's history. History moving through you. And Marx literally says, you cannot completely control history. It's there before you. But of course you have an influence on where it goes. You have self-efficacy, and you encounter a power which is stronger than you in the end, right? So it connects you with the past and with the future generations. So the power of history runs through you. So I think there are different ways of conceptualizing a vertical axis of resonance, but religion certainly is a powerful way of doing it. And for me, it's not so much about the theology, it's also about the practice, like prayer or singing, and even going to church, because it sets the disposition a certain way, which makes you sensible to vertical resonance.
Yes, I would like to move to another axis of resonance, mm-hmm. what you call the horizontal axis of resonance, more about the religion. So in this part, you speak about family, you speak about love, friendship, but I would, maybe that will come back when we will have the discussion and the questions from the assembly, but I would like you to explain us a bit what you understand with your concept of resonance, how you analyze the aspect of politics.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a very interesting thing that you do. You mentioned it works in German and in French, but not so well in English. In German and in French, when you speak about the votes that you put in the ballot, you speak of la voix, les voix. Huh? So it's voices. It doesn't work in English. But in French, it's the same word for the voice and the vote. From then, you explain. I mean, my question would be, is it possible to have some kind of, what are the conditions, basically, for producing something like a music in the democratic world? Is it possible or not? Because I would say there is something in the idea of resonance that sometimes, yeah, we can form something like a music, but sometimes not, or most of the time not.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's, you said that quite rightly before. I do not think of resonance as pure harmony.
No.
Yeah, and there is this danger of, if one thinks about love and friendship, right? I mean, what I do, right? Then you're already on the track of, oh yeah, the world totally in harmony, right? And that's not what I mean. I mean, resonance means you hear something that speaks its own voice, and that can be very disturbing. By the way, in religion and nature, of course, you have these experiences too. Religion can be a troubling thing, right? I mean, even the Bible, I think actually it's interesting. I take it that many of you are believers. And I personally, I'm not so much a fan of the Bible. I turned Christian because of the music, really. But I know, yeah, when I heard the organ, I couldn't do anything then but go there. But okay, a lot of people take the Bible as a kind of a sphere of resonance. It says something, at some places it says terrible things, right? So it's not harmony, right? It's kind of contradiction, but you have the feeling, well, there might be something there, but I don't take it. I do not accept it, right? I'm against what you say. And this can be in a discussion, right? Like when we discuss or others discuss. we have the feeling, no, that's not right what you are saying, right? I think you're wrong. But it's still resonance if we are open to the arguments of the other, right? And you really feel, if you have friends, I mean, I'm sure you have friends, right? I have the best friend. I meet whenever we meet, we disagree on almost everything. And that's, of course, what makes it interesting. And sometimes we are very fierce about it, right? We might even call each other idiots or so. But the thing is, I still want to hear what he has to say, and he wants to hear what I have to say, and we somehow try to answer it, and while I answer, I transform my opinion in order to capture the truth in what he might have to say. But there is a point where this changes, where I don't want, I mean, not with my friends normally, but with enemies or so, sometimes with colleagues, right? That's bad if that happens. There I really, you know, let's take an imaginary example like the two of us, right? We might fiercely debate on whether or not religion, for example, is resonance a religious concept, right? Mm-hmm. I say no, and you say yes. Yeah. And we might really get very, but then there is a point where it breaks, and I say, you know what, you're just an idiot, shut up and go away. And you really see, we might still be talking, but you see how this, then you close down. You no longer want to be affected by the other, and you no longer want to reach the other. You want to command or control or destroy him. So now I believe that democracy really is the promise that we can create a community. I really think it's the community or a common good where we can be in resonance with each other and with the community we create. And it's exactly along what you just said. It's the idea of giving everyone a voice. And it's not the voice which you cast in the ballot as the vote, right? It's the voice which you can make heard. But it only has sense if you also hear the voices of the other. I think that's a part of the problem of the current political crisis. People feel their voices are not heard, and therefore they take to the Front National or to the streets. But there they want to shout down the others, right? We don't want to hear the others anymore. And that, of course, is a very bad state of affairs. I believe democracy really is the promise, and it only works in the old Republican sense. People talking to each other and listening and hearing, well, there is someone saying something different. He might have a different belief or different interests, right? And I hear what he or she has to say, or they have to say. And I try to answer with my own convictions. I do not give them up. I answer with my own voice. And in setting the two voices in a kind of dialogue or encounter, we both transform. That's the basis of resonance, right? While I talk to you and try to see your point, but also try to keep my own perspective, I change and you change. And this is how a communal world is possible. If we do this, we can collectively shape our society, even though we have different interests and different opinions and different convictions. And right now, this is exactly what we lack. When politicians talk to each other, and it's not their fault, it's the way our society is set up, and it has to do with dynamic stabilization. But when you think of what politicians do, it's certainly not getting touched and transformed by the others. Right? You have a talk show, for example. Certainly you may not be convinced by the argument of the others, right? What you do is really they use it as points of aggression. I listen to what you say in order to find the point where I can prove you wrong and prove my own position to be superior. And that's the logic of parliamentary debate too. And even, it's by the way, it's the logic of scientific debates. When you go to a scientific congress, people sit there, I think I do it myself, that's what we learned, right? With an attitude of aggression, and it's a kind of, you don't even notice. The thing is, you listen to it and you desperately search for the point where you can say, oh, but that's wrong, right? or here my own view, position is superior. And then if it doesn't work in talk shows and parliamentary debates, it doesn't work on the streets either. People go out there in order to silence the others because we think they are either fascists or traitors or whatever. But this fine sense of democracy and therefore the nation, if you like, or Europe, I'm desperately in favor of Europe, being a project of resonance where we listen to the others, where we answer and transform into a common good, is kind of lost, but we should regain it and start with it right now.
Yes, I think that's the good point to move on to another aspect of what you try to do now that we've understood a little better what resonance is all about in various aspects of dimensions of our life. As a sociologist, you're interested always in the socio-cultural conditions that favor or impede, in this case, resonance. And but you are also offering this concept as a tool for a theory of social critique. And in the book, you try to do a reading of modernity and understanding of modernity, and you say, yeah, basically, modernity, you interpret modernity as both a story of a catastrophe of resonance, but at the same time, you say also it's a story of a growing sensibility to and desire for resonance. So could you tell us a bit about this way of understanding modernity and the consequences?
It's like a Janus phase, it's ambivalence, Yeah, it's exactly as you say. When I started to write the book, I thought, okay, interesting. Modernity is really spectacularly successful in bringing the world within reach, making the world available, or I call it the triple A approach to the good life. It's the idea that the point in life, individual and collective, is making more of the world available or attainable or accessible, right? Actually, it might have started with Columbus, for example, right? Making more of the world available, attainable, and accessible. Knowing what there is at the end of the ocean, finding a way to get there, and then commanding and controlling it, probably, right? And we still do the same thing with our satellites. We want to go deeper into, or the telescopes, look deeper into space, making more of it available, attainable. With a microscope, looking deeper into matter, right? And all the time we try, technologically, for example, all the transport technologies have made the world available for you. Even the bike, the velocitas, right? Increases the horizon of where you can get on your everyday routes. And then, of course, the car increases that horizon significantly. And then the plane even increases it once more. And that's where we are right now. But Musk and others are dreaming of rockets, but let's forget about that. But, I mean, look at what the smartphone does, right? I see, right, that most of you have it and we have it. And we're now kind of almost, it's always in my hand. Why? Because I have all the world available here. Everything, all the knowledge in the world is one click away. And all my friends, one click away. And all the goods I can order, if I have enough money, is just one click away. So I thought, okay, modernity is spectacularly successful in bringing the world within reach. But at the same time, it becomes a silent world, a world that no longer speaks to us. It's a world that is turned into a point of aggression. So as you said, I thought modernity has this double face. We make the world available, attainable, accessible, and at the same time it turns mute and silent, right? We feel we lose it. And now I could divert on a 20 minutes talk on how modern philosophy and sociology and literature is about this sense of alienation, right? I mean, Marx called it alienation. We are alienated from each other, from nature, from work. And Max Weber calls it disenchantment. Disenchantment. The world stops to sing, literally, right? And Camus, for example, says, I mean, the existentialism had this, Camus says we have to face the experience that we cannot but shout into the world, and the experience that it is silent or even hostile. That is the basic experience, right, of our existence. It's the birth of the absurd. And then all his life he was looking for nevertheless some resources for getting into resonance. So the short story is, I thought modernity is about increasing the horizon of what is possible and losing resonance. And then I realized that's totally wrong, because modernity is also about increasing our sensibility and our desire for resonance. Think of the way we think of love, right? Relationships between people, I mean, men and or spouses, right? Could be men and men or men and women. It doesn't matter. Those who love each other are now supposed to be not relationships of economic dominance or of hierarchy or whatever, but resonance, two voices reaching out to each other and being transformed and touching each other. And it's the same way we think about our children. We are not thinking about our children as an economic asset that will care for us. And we don't think of them as something we have to train and discipline, right? The idea is the child needs to develop, or we want to help them him or her to develop their own voice and then get into dialogue with him or her. And we think in this way of friendship. What is friendship? Having a voice out there speaking to us. And most interestingly, all the axes I talked about earlier, that nature is an axis of resonance, that art is an axis of resonance, that history is an axis of resonance. And even in the particular way religion is supposed to be an axis of resonance, they are all modern inventions. Basically, they were formulated by the Romantics. So yes, modernity creates sensitivity for resonance and the desire for resonance. But at the same time, it kind of makes it very hard for us. And in late modernity, I would say close to, only close to, impossible because of this, you know, what we said before, because this need to, I mean, look, I mean, you talk about the conditions. When you are short of time, short on time, short of time, right? You have to run to the station because your train leaves or to the airport because the plane leaves. Then, of course, you may not get into resonance with anything or anyone, right? Because then you will miss the train or the plane, right? So whenever you're short on time, you have to close down to all possible sources of resonance. But it's worse than that. Resonance means you allow yourself to be open and to enter into a process which you cannot control, into a process that transforms you in a way you cannot predict. Well, this is something we simply cannot afford. No company, a lot of you are running companies, right, or are managers. You cannot allow for processes which you cannot control or predict. What you do all the time is to increase, optimize, speed up, increase productivity. You have to control and to document and to make transparent and so on. So I would say the logic of what I call dynamic stabilization, the need to permanently increase productivity and to optimize processes is very hostile. We no longer allow ourselves to be vulnerable, but to be in a mode of resonance means make yourself vulnerable. You will be touched by something, and worse than that, you will be touched by something you cannot control. This is an attitude, a disposition which we can no longer afford, and in that sense, modernity has turned into a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what you say about what you call the oasis of resonance, because it's true that because we are in this world that is going faster and faster, but at the same time we have desire for resonance. So yes, sometimes we can think, I will find resonance, or I will work hard the whole week, but on Friday night I will go to the concert.
Yes.
I will go to the Wien Philharmonia or the Salle Pleyel, or I will go to a garage and listen to heavy metal or whatever I will find. Or we'll go in my family during this weekend, or we go in the other side of the world and I will have 1 week of vacation and we find resonance. But is it really, the problem is that now we see all those things, they also enter into this market world. I mean, we can feel that the advertisement are just selling also some spaces of resonance. So if all the resonance now is entering into the whole process of this economic growth, how can it still be resonant?
Yeah, but well, maybe it isn't, right? I mean, I think it's, what is very interesting is that I think, let's call it capitalism, right? As a sociologist, I never have a problem with that term, right? I mean, what a capitalist economy does is it turns our desire for resonance, because I believe that's the basic human desire, right? Getting into a relationship, into an answer. If you watch small kids, very small kids, they do not want to have, right? They permanently want to create resonance, right? To get a reaction, get things to answer. And by the way, that's the way how they survive, right? If they get resonance from the parents or by those who care for them. So I think this desire for resonance is a basic desire. And capitalism transforms the desire for resonance into a desire for objects, for commodities. It's really interesting when you watch advertisements, la publicité, right? You see every time they try to sell you an experience of resonance. For example, buy this trip to Africa and you will have a real encounter with nature or so, right? Or buy this car. And then you will have an experience of self-efficacy. You are in control of the world and you will travel through the world and experience it and yourself. Or even there's an advertisement right now, buy this potato chips And then you will have real friends, right, coming by this perfume, and you will have a new experience of your own body, right? So they always, it's really always, the desire is always resonance with nature, with others, with yourself. But what they sell you is the perfume or the chips or the car, right? So that the desire for resonance is transformed into a desire for an object. And then we think the resonance, or basically we think what we desire is in this object. And of course it's not in the object. I mean, for Marx, this was fetishization. A journalist pointed that out today to me, and I think exactly I should take up that argument too. It's the fetish, right? The commodity is supposed to carry what should be in the relationship. And the interesting thing is, then we are dissatisfied with the object, but in a very specific sense, not in the sense that we stop buying objects, but in the sense that we buy a new object, another object. This is very strange, right? We stay in the process because we never find what we want to find. So I'd say yes, capitalism is kind of, I call it reification or commodification of resonance. And it doesn't really work in the way you describe it, right? It's like I buy the most expensive concert cards for tickets for a concert, and then I go there, and then I don't. Very likely, I think probably it's an inverse relationship. The more you pay for the tickets, the less likely is that you really are touched and transformed, right? But of course, when you move out, when you go out, when you leave the concert, you need to convince yourself and others that it was such a wonderful experience. It was extraordinary, right? And actually, the entertainment industry reacts to this by trying to overwhelm you. They sometimes even advertise it like this. This will be the loudest show you've ever been to, right? Or we have the most spectacular lights. But being overwhelmed is not resonance. I was just in Vienna last week, and they actually had an advertisement which said, this will be the largest performance of Swan Lake you ever were to. The largest, because it had the most artists included. That's not resonance, right? I mean, so these oases of resonance very often, most of the time, don't give us what we are what we are seeking. And yeah, bad enough. Yes.
A last point, I mean, in a different sphere, but I think it's interesting also to hear you on that. It was an article that was published in Revue Projet a few months ago in this issue, but it was at the end of the Revue Projet, you have always an article that is not part of the whole dossier. And it was about like a follow-up of another issue of the Revue Projet, and it was about the question, what is happening in Europe relating to the migrants, and why, how would you explain with, you make a very interesting analysis of this crisis of hospitality, of this crisis, migrant crisis, and giving some clue about two ways of responding, basically, as this challenge of welcoming the migrants. And and it's probably a way of illustrating also how your concept, I mean, is helping also to figure out, to map out certain ways. So I give you the...
Well, but that means you finish with the most difficult of all questions, right?
Yeah, but there will be the discussion.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm a sociologist. I look at society, right? What do we do? What can I observe if I just watch what's going on there? And I find something really peculiar. It's, by the way, it's not only in Europe. It's the same in the United States when you think of Trump, right? I mean, what is the dominating image of self-world relationship almost, right? Or of political world relationship? The dominating image right now is the image of building a fence, building a wall, making a fortress of Europe or so. And as a sociologist, I wonder what's going on there. And I think this is a clear sign that the way we relate to the world has become very precarious. The world is a danger. We perceive it as a danger. Right. Those moments of an alien world which speaks to us, which approaches us. I mean, in Europe, they're literally approaching us. They have eyes, they have a voice. That is normally the call for resonance. If you look into someone's eyes, right, that really is the moment where you are called for resonance. I go there with Levinas or with the Buber. I believe you can build the whole ethics on this, right? Looking into someone's eyes or hearing someone's voice, as human beings, we are called upon opening up and answering, right? So what do we do when the world is coming? We are in panic. Let's build walls, let's build fences, let's build a fortress, right? So I think probably this sense of threat has reasons different from those who are coming, right? I read it as a sign that we feel totally powerless, right? Without self-efficacy. The fear is that if they are coming, then there's nothing we can answer, right? Then we have to build minarets all over the place. All our churches will go away. And of course, that means we don't believe in the possibility even of resonance, because resonance does not mean we give in to those who are coming. It means we enter into a kind of dialogue where we speak our own voice. Yes, we do have our values and we do have our traditions and we believe in them. And let's hear what you have to say and what your ideas are. And then when we enter into this kind of dialogue, yes, we will transform. I would really say it's true. I mean, you know, in Germany, the AfD says, but if we accept 1 million refugees, we will have to transform. And then, of course, my answer is yes, exactly. That's life. Being alive means being capable and willing to transform, but of course not in a powerless way, right, where the other determines what I am, but in this process of self-efficacy where I have my own voice and which I have a kind of even strong voice. You know, basically I just said a few minutes ago, being capable of resonance means being capable of making yourself vulnerable. And yes, it's true, if you accept those immigrants, we make ourselves vulnerable. We are going to be transformed in a certain sense. We do not yet know. But the one thing I'm pretty sure about is if we say, no, we don't want to be transformed, we don't want to be touched, we want to build walls, fences, and fortresses, then we will die. Because that's the end of life. Life means opening up, being touched and transformed all the time. And therefore, that's the two ways, right? I think we have a dangerous choice, opening up, being ready to engage in the world, even letting the world in, not totally uncontrolled. Because if you have totally uncontrolled immigration, then you certainly lose your own voice, right? But nevertheless, if we either are capable of opening up to these other voices and eyes and people and bodies and transform in a dangerous way, or we close down and we will really die. Actually, we will even literally die out in the long run. Maybe one more. Let me just make one more sense from the point of sociologists, one more observation. I'm not exactly sure about the French situation here, but when you look at Middle Eastern Europe, or let's just take Germany, right? I mean, we have some areas, rural areas, because most people move to the cities, right? But in some rural areas, particularly in Eastern Germany, they're really in a bad situation, right? The kindergarten is gone long ago. The schools are about to close down because there are no kids, right? And the swimming pool is about to disappear. And even the railway says, oh, you know, it's no longer, it's not economically profitable to run the railway line to your little city. And the banks say, you know what, there's not enough traffic, we will close this bank account. And even the small local store is about to close down because there are only old people left behind. So what does a country like this or a village like this need? It needs an influx. It needs new people, new hope, young people, right? People who want to shape society, to reinvent it. So I think they most definitely need, actually they need immigrants. They need new people there. But in those areas, they are most hostile, right? They have never seen a person who is not from a Middle European background. But they are totally convinced if someone's coming, that means the end of our life. But it's the opposite way. If no one's coming, it means the end of the life they are having, right? So that's why I think, I really think, because you asked about the immigration policy, my idea is we have to combine infrastructural policy with immigration policies. I mean, those villages, I would really tell, we promise, we as a society promise The kindergarten will be kept, the school will open, the railway will run, and even the local store will be kept open. When you take in 5 or maybe 10 families coming from Syria or from wherever they might be, and of course then it's not a faceless threat of the world uncontrollable. It's people with eyes and voices which then can reinvent society. That's my hope for a better world in the future.
Thank you, Hartmut. Merci, Hartmut. Merci, Grégoire. Maintenant, c'est à vous et à vos questions, en français ou en anglais, comme vous le souhaitez. Tristan et François vont passer avec le micro dans la salle. Pour ceux qui suivent la conférence à distance, il y a 8 personnes à Nancy, une dizaine de personnes dans les Yvelines, un groupe à Dijon, à Aix et dans d'autres villes. Vous pouvez envoyer vos questions par SMS adossées au 06 76 76 17 13.
Oui.
Je vous remercie beaucoup d'avoir présenté ce concept qui est très, très, très éclairant, très, très intéressant. J'aurais souhaité en entendre un petit peu plus sur la dimension sociale, parce que on a l'impression que votre concept est assez individuel au fond. C'est une affaire d'individus. Mais d'abord, il me semble que, par exemple, vous parlez de résonance dans le domaine de l'art. Il y a beaucoup d'études qui montrent que c'est une réponse sociale. L'art se construit à travers un public, pas à travers une relation individuelle. De la même façon, est-ce qu'une société justement, une société humaine, elle réagit par une réponse sociale, comme le décrit très bien Luhmann, face à la complexité. Donc, est-ce que vous pouvez nous expliquer comment vous articulez cette question de la résonance, que vous avez beaucoup décrit dans des termes presque psychologiques, et finalement, une réponse sociale?
Yes, thank you very much. This is a very good and very important question, really. Because you're absolutely right. It sounds like it's a kind of a thing between me and the world, and then it's not political and not even a social. I mean, the concept of resonance. When I wrote the book on acceleration, I think I was only on the social side because I said it's a structural problem, an institutional problem. There is nothing we can do as individuals, right? I mean, it's not that I have a better time management or a self-help book or so, and then the problem is solved. I cannot individually solve the social problem. And Adorno says there is no good life, no right life in the wrong context, so to speak. And then people said, well, but it's not that we cannot do anything, right? And I thought, because they said it also depends on us. And as a sociologist, I always thought, no, it doesn't depend on you. And now I say it also depends on us because I have this new idea, or maybe it's not new, but for me it was new, that I say society requires growth and acceleration and innovation. But it's not the structures who accelerate and innovate. It's us. We have to provide the social energy that feeds these engines. And the social energy, there is psychological energy. It's the desire. I really believe that's important. It's our desire to some extent, right, which provides the energy for the logic of the institutions. And this energy is provided in two ways. One is fear. I think fear is maybe the most powerful motor, because if you don't run along, if you say, I refuse, you're just kind of eliminated economically and structurally and even culturally. But there is also an element of desire, and that's our conception of the good life, right? That's our conception that if we increase the reach of what is available, attainable, and accessible, our life gets better. Therefore, I will give a second part in the answer, right? But I do have a certain hope that by culturally changing our conception of the good life, it's like pulling the plug, which takes the energy out of the system, which forces even structures and institutions to somehow react to it. Therefore, I believe there is a connection between the individual and the collective side. Nevertheless, resonance has two sides. It's not just me who can get in resonance, because it can also fail on the world side. And as I just said, for example, competition and fear and the scarcity of time leads to the consequence that we will not be in resonance with the world. And if you want to change that, we need to have something like even a political and economic revolution. That's what I think. I dream of a political reform, at least. I learned today that Macron uses the term reform all the time, right? So, okay, let's... I want a very thorough reform of the economic system, which, and of the political system, which actually says, let's have less rather than more competition, and maybe something like a minimum basic income for everyone, because that would take the fear out of the game. But nevertheless, I do agree with you. We do need institutional forms of action, and the goal of this should be that we get out of this logic of dynamic stabilization, where we have to permanently optimize just to stay where we are. So this new institutional set I call adaptive stabilization, but I have not yet worked it out. I mean, I hope for the French to come up with a new innovative design there. Okay.
Thank you very much. It's really exciting, really, really important what you have done. But I have a question a little bit on the dark side of this powerful process that is resonance, because it's powerful. It produces very important things. But what happens if people resonate only with their similar ones?
Yeah.
What happens if, or this is not an important question.
No,
we know what could happen.
Yeah.
But let's take the serious one. What condition can be created by groups, civil society, institutions, and our deliberate effort of collective action to create the condition to open up those with whom we will resonate? Because till the moment that we haven't conditioned for opening the resonance, we will resonate with the world, but in reality not with the world, with a part of the world.
Yeah.
We will resonate with the other, and not with the other, with some of these others
yes.
that are very homophilic with us. So how to? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that this is a totally different, totally important question, and it's a bit different from how I know it. So I actually have to think, right? No, because I mean, you know, when I started to think about resonance, I was really shocked because I understood, right? When someone said, "Well, when I hear resonance, I feel totally uneasy." To be honest, I almost want to run away. That's what someone said, because I think of the Nazis in Germany, right? The National Socialists, weren't they very good at creating a sphere of resonance with their songs, with their uniforms, with the fires they would carry, and so on. And at that time I thought, well, he's probably right. That's resonance. And now then in the book I actually take along, I try to convince that this is not resonance, because the Nazis wanted to shut out all the other voices. Everyone who is not like me or like us should be silent, right? And my claim is that if you do this, then you don't even hear your own voice. It's only the voice of the leader. It's just one voice, and that's not resonance. It's not another you hear. It's no, that was the short version. And also, I think I find this really interesting. I mean, it's even I find it interesting when you say, well, I want to resonate. I only resonate with the others who are like me. Then you have to keep the others away. It's like talking about refugees, right? If someone says, oh, these refugees should stay away, I found really, really interesting the gesture and the voice and the face of someone saying this. It's impossible not to be this gesture and this face and voice, right? Oh, no, they should stay away. You really see and feel it means closing, right? And therefore, I say if you shut down to some group of society or to some outsiders, like you could actually say, well, I don't care how my T-shirt is produced in Bangladesh, because I resonate with you, right? So why should I care about those in Bangladesh? And I have the idea, it's really the idea of founding an ethics on resonance, that as soon as you say, I don't care for them, this leads to a closing of your mind and of your bodies. That makes it impossible to have resonance even on the inside, right? So so this doesn't work. But now your question was, well, what do I do if the others don't want to resonate? Was that your question?
The question was that maybe I don't want to close.
Yes.
I don't want to
yes.
follow a crazy leader.
Yeah.
It simply happens in some condition, for instance, of metropolitan societies, that I resonate only with the people I meet, and these people are quite similar.
I don't see the others, you mean. I never see and meet the others.
Yeah, I meet the others, but the others are quite similar to me.
Yes. Yeah.
That it's not that I want to close. It's really an ethic of resonance. But still, I'm in the bubble. And it not depends by me.
My
question is, what can we do to create the condition that I will not resonate only with those who are similar
I see what you mean.
To me?
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, I think this is really important. I just discussed this with a colleague, and actually I was close to becoming a kind of guest professor in Paris, right? I even wrote a kind of a schedule for that, and for some reason it didn't work out. And that what it was exactly addressing this problem. I believe a democratic sphere, like our modern society, only works if it has sufficient common ground where people of different bubbles actually meet and interact, right? And we are really, I totally agree, I think that's what you mean. We are creating a world, a metropolitan world, right, where our life worlds don't intersect anymore, right? I don't meet these others, neither in school nor in the shops. I have different media and so on. So this, I agree, this would create a very bad problem. So democracy, in my understanding, only works if we have enough common ground. And for example, publicly funded media are deadly important for that. I mean, you know, we had the debate in Switzerland where they said, well, everyone can have his or her own TV and radio channel. That creates these bubbles, right? So the media have really, really the challenge of creating a ground where the different voices are heard. And then also the schools, of course. We somehow have to create and fund schools where the different segments of society interact. And we have to create political institutions where the democratic process really leads to real-world interaction between the voices. So I think we have to think of public places, public spheres, and forms of dialogue which set all these different worlds and voices in dialogue. And I have the same hunch like you have. This is an institutional task. I don't have a complete picture, but I have some ideas on how to do it. I will be shorter next time, I promise.
A question from Evelyne. As you explained, mondialization should support resonance.
Yeah.
But is there a risk of losing our identity?
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, when I started doing social theory, social philosophy, I thought it's important to have and keep one's identity, right? But now I've almost given up the concept of identity because I think it's not necessary that I always have to stay who I am, right? I mean, life means I change, right? Right now I might be a Christian, but it is possible that soon I'm an atheist or a Muslim or whatever. It's not very possible, but it is possible, right? And that is not bad in itself. But what would be bad is if I lose my own voice, right? If I'm affected by everyone, if I answer, if I'm in resonance all the time with everyone I encounter, I do not have a voice of my own to answer, right? I mean, that's the way I try to conceptualize it. So I would say there is a danger, as you say, that I lose my own voice. It becomes actually tricky when you, individually, I would say that's very easy. If I'm here with you, I feel I'm totally Christian. If I'm tomorrow with the communists, I feel I'm totally atheist. And if I then am if every day whoever I'm with convinces me, then I'm not in resonance because then it's only I'm affected all the time. I'm not answering, right? So I think that what most people think of with identity is having this own voice, hearing your own voice and answering. And it's not a problem if we are transformed. The interesting it's really an interesting question, but I always try to be as honest as possible. If you apply this to a society, then you could probably say if you open up the borders completely, you might lose your own voice, right? I think it's probably there is some truth to it. What I always try to say is resonance is only possible if you're open enough to be touched and transformed by some other. But you have to be closed enough to have your own frequency. It's, you see it actually, you see it in physical terms. If you have an instrument like a violin, let's say a violin or a guitar, right? It has to be open in order to be affected to sound, but it has to be closed in order to have a body that can sound. If you build the guitar out of styropor, I think it's called styrofoam, right? That styrofoam, then it will not sound at all. So I think there is this danger that you lose the own frequency, the capacity to answer.
Thanks for this talk and discussion. You are one of the most insightful social theorists of our time, and I also think that you are a political theorist, because what you militate for, what you advocate, is to enhance resonance in our societies.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Now, I try to be a bit dissonant.
Okay.
If you were a sociologist, good. Because yeah, I don't think you're a sociologist, if you want to enhance resonance, if you want to have more resonance, you have to measure resonance know how much resonance we have.
Yeah, yeah.
How would you do it?
Yeah, okay, that's not very dissonant, because I somehow agree with you. I mean, it's a very interesting question. No, I do agree. But I mean, there's an ambivalence which you probably would accept. I mean, it's interesting, because I just had a seminar with a psychologist. So there were students from psychology and students from sociology. And the psychologist said, if you cannot measure it at all, it might be an esoterical or a political concept, but not a sociological concept, right? It's not a scientific concept at all, right? So go to the esoteric self-help section. And my students hated that argument, right? And I said they are right. I really think so, right? If there would be no way, because for me, resonance is not it's not even an emotion, and it's certainly not a subjective emotion. Resonance is a form of relationship. And it has to satisfy my four elements, right? Being affected, being self-efficacy, being transformed. And I think, why should it be impossible? I think it is possible to actually observe, for example, in dialogue, whether those four elements are present or not. And then it's no longer subjective judgment. For example, when the two of us talk and I say, oh, it was so resonant, and you say it wasn't resonating at all. So I think it could be, if we are filmed, some experts probably could say whether there was real resonance or whether I was talking to myself, right, and projecting outward or so. And there's a second element where I say resonance has a physical side. It's a bodily reaction. As I said, the eyes which beam up, or sometimes there are even tears in our eyes, right? But even if it's not that strong, you can see bodily, it's a bodily feeling. And whenever bodies are involved, you can measure it, you can make it visible with the brain, scanning technologies. So it's not the brain that causes resonance, but resonance has a kind of neuronal basis. So that's where I have an answer to what you say, right? I can measure it. But the problem with it is, as soon as you can measure something, you can try to increase it and to manipulate it, right? And then, of course, resonance would be just part of, not only have to grow economically and speed up, but now we even have to make our lives more resonant or so. And that would be really bad. And therefore, I say, I believe we can measure it, but you cannot increase it. Right, at least not technologically. And my example for this is, I really like it. I think it's a good argument, so I have to present it to you. I mean, let's assume I play 20 different songs to you. Let's say to you personally, right? And then, of course, you would say, "Oh, this is the song which really touches me," right? And probably the brain scans would confirm it, right? With this song. Probably it would be Pink Floyd, because they are the best, right? No, okay, Iron Maiden. Okay, whatever. Then it could be Bruckner or whatever. Let's say it's just one song. And there you have really resonance. You might have tears in your eyes. And then you say, oh, finally, I found it. Now I play it every day, or I play it twice a day. And then you will not get more resonance. You will actually lose it, right? So the fact that we can measure it doesn't necessarily mean that we can control and increase it. That's my hope and my way out. It's the problem is with English, right? But they can ask in French. Yeah. Okay.
Merci. Je voulais revenir sur, vous avez parlé des achats. Vous avez parlé maintenant, de plus en plus, les entreprises ne vendent plus un produit, mais la fonction que doit assurer ce produit. Bon, Renault.
Une
voiture.
Yes.
On est bien, etc.
Yeah.
Est-ce que ceci, vous le reliez, vous pouvez le relier à la résonance?
What was the last? Yeah, I mean, I think sociologically, what you say is very important, really, because I think it's spectacular. There's a spectacular change in reality. It's exactly what you describe. They no longer sell us the product, but the service. I mean, you see it with these iPhones, right? It's an iPhone, right? And I need to be attached, even addicted to Apple, but not to this particular thing, because next year they want to sell me a new one. This is really spectacular, right? I mean, how is it done that I'm attached to the iPhone or to Apple, but not to this physical substance? But is it resonance? I mean, I would say, I think it still has the same logic. They sell me a service, you could say, right? Or a certain mode of supplying services. And I think that's, you know, the desire for resonance is then transformed in the desire for this mode, or maybe for this label or for this sign. So, but it's still a commodification of resonance, right? They do sell me the brand, while I desire a form of relationship. So I believe the logic is still the same, right? My desire of towards resonance is transformed into a desire for Apple, but no longer the physical substance. I find this very interesting. But I have rather the feeling, somehow I have to admit, I mean, it's strange, because resonance is an optimistic concept, isn't it? But generally, I'm quite culturally pessimistic. And therefore, I think, I have the feeling, I don't know what you think, I think it was better when at least I was attached to this material thing than when I think this thing doesn't matter to me at all. I'm ready to throw it away anytime. I'm just attached to a mode of operating in an enterprise. So I have the feeling that this is not a way forward towards resonance. It's rather a way deeper into alienation. I mean, we have the same logic with music. I mean, this has always been my favorite example, right? Since I'm addicted to music, right? I mean, we or with books, but let's take music, or even with films, it's the same thing. We always tried, not always, in the last decades, we tried to get the physical substance to buy the record or the CD at least, right? And to take it home and appropriate it in the sense of unverwandeln, it's existential or transformative appropriation. This is the new Pink Floyd CD. It's now my Pink Floyd CD, and I put it into the shelf. And now you no longer buy a CD. You don't even buy a single product. I just buy the service of Spotify, which gives me 9 million titles of music to access. And I think this is not increasing my experiences of resonance with music. It's rather decreasing it. Yeah.
Bon, j'ai la chance de pouvoir vous poser une deuxième question. Oui, tout à l'heure, dans votre démonstration, vous avez dit que, selon vous, la modernité accroissait le désir de résonance. Et en même temps, vous avez dit que le monde devient muet. Et comme démonstration, vous avez dit, par exemple, les relations aujourd'hui s'approfondissent, par exemple... Avant, les relations entre les parents, enfin, dans un couple, entre les enfants et les parents étaient dominées par des dimensions économiques, aujourd'hui elles deviennent plus vraies. Je me demande si c'est si vrai. Et d'une manière générale, peut-être en étant un peu provocant, je me demande si vous avez, au fond, un désir de sauver la modernité, finalement, en disant qu'elle accroît ce désir de résonance.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's an interesting question too. I mean, in the way I hope I understood it correctly and have because I have an idea of how to answer it. I mean, in my books, I make a distinction between the project of modernity and the process of modernization. And I would actually say the project of modernity includes this desire for resonance, but I think maybe it a bit in a one-sided way. I mean, I would agree with Jürgen Habermas, for example, or also with Charles Taylor, saying that the project of modernity, the normative, the value and the desire is for autonomy, that I can speak my voice freely and develop it in a certain way, right? And that I think that, for me, that's the project of modernity, and I would want to keep that, even though I think autonomy should not be the only value, or maybe not even the highest value, because resonance is not when I'm in complete control of everything. Adorno makes this point very beautifully. He says, you know, the real experience is actually, at least for a short time, losing autonomy. You know, when you're really in resonance, you fall in love with someone, then you're no longer in control. You don't live, you know, autonomy. My colleagues define autonomy as a life led according to self-chosen principles and norms. And I think, you know, I mean, the most important experiences in your life were experiences where you actually deviated from your principles and norms, right? You encountered something. You hear something, or you see something, or you meet someone who makes you deviate from what you wanted to do. And you feel even overpowered by this other thing, right? So I don't think the project of modernity is only about autonomy, but it's important in the sense of, yes, you should have the possibility to speak your voice and to live according to your frequency. But the process of modernization, which in the beginning was very close to this project but then deviated, is this logic of speeding up, growing and increasing as a form of reproducing the institutional structure, right? For me, modernization means a society which is in a mode of dynamic stabilization. It needs every year to increase productivity, to grow and to speed up in order to keep its shape. And this form of modernization I would actually want to overcome, right? I think we need to get out of this need, out of the hamster wheel in order to save the project of modernity, right? So my answer is a kind of split in modernity. I want to keep the project, but to give up this problematic process. All right.
Merci Hartmut, merci Grégoire. Je pense qu'on peut les applaudir. Donc, pour conclure, j'ai un petit cadeau pour raisonner. Oh. Voilà.
Oh, vous êtes très gentil. Oui. Merci beaucoup. Oh, c'est grand. Merci beaucoup.
Donc, notre prochaine rencontre sera consacrée à la présentation des 10 propositions du MCC pour réenchanter notre travail, avec un intervenant que nous vous révélerons prochainement. Vous recevrez une invitation par le lien Meetup par lequel vous êtes inscrit. Maintenant, quelques annonces pour la suite de notre soirée. Pour poursuivre nos échanges, nous vous convions maintenant à venir partager un verre dans la salle d'à côté. Vous pourrez acheter les livres de notre invité et les faire dédicacer. Vous pourrez aussi, pour ceux qui le souhaitent, en savoir plus sur le MCC. Nous laissez vos coordonnées. Les responsables de la région Paris seront à votre écoute et à votre disposition pour vous accueillir dans la salle du cocktail. Voilà, je crois que je n'ai rien oublié. Merci à tous.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, clinical psychology and psychology generally is very